KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Confusion reigns this week in the Middle East as Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri remains missing in Saudi Arabia, and questions swirl around his apparent resignation. Hariri's disappearance earlier this month came as Saudi Arabia's king and crown prince orchestrated a purge of dozens of politicians and businessmen and earned the support of President Trump in the process. We'll discuss the political situation in Saudi Arabia. We'll also get an update on the crisis in Yemen, and we'll look at how longstanding hostility between Saudi Arabia and Iran is fueling region-wide conflict. It's all coming up next, after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Tensions in the Middle East continue to mount as Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri remains in Saudi Arabia, sparking suspicion that he's being held against his will. Hariri disappeared into Saudi Arabia just as Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman orchestrated a purge of dozens of Saudi ministers, politicians, and businessmen. At the same time, Saudi Arabia continues its blockade of war-torn Yemen, which is experiencing a catastrophic humanitarian crisis as millions face starvation and death. And in response, the United States House of Representatives passed a non-binding resolution just last night stating that the U.S. military assistance to Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen is unauthorized. Meanwhile, the death toll continues to rise from an earthquake along the Iran-Iraq border Sunday night, which so far has killed at least 500 people and injured at least 7,000. And in this hour, we discuss the latest developments in the Middle East. Joining us, let me tell you who is joining us from Washington, D.C., Hanin Gadar, whom we welcome, who's a Friedman Visiting Fellow at the Washington Institute, where she focuses on Shiite politics in the Levant. Welcome, Hanin Gadar.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Aaron David Miller back with us on Foreign Vice President for New Initiatives and Distinguished Fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, former negotiator and advisor on Middle East issues for both Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State, and author of most recent book, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Welcome back, Aaron David Miller.
Always a pleasure to be on this show.
Pleasure to have you, and also a pleasure to have Janine Zakaria, who's here with us in studio, visiting lecturer at Stanford, former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome, Janine.
Hi, Michael.
Hi. Let me begin, Hanin Gadar, with you, because much here is mysterious, and perhaps you can shed some light for us and help us understand what's going on. There's a great deal of intrigue and a great deal of speculation, to put it mildly, with Prime Minister Hariri now being in Saudi Arabia rather than in his home country. Many people think held hostage, kidnapped, forced to use what's been described as vituperative rhetoric against Hezbollah, and really maybe siding with the Saudis, at least in terms of what they want to get done there. How do you see it?
Yeah. Let me start with the resignation itself. Hariri's resignation did come from Saudi Arabia. It came from Riyadh. And the way, the tone of the resignation was very similar to Saudi's tone and rhetoric about Iran. It was not very clear what happened before the resignation, but the things that happened afterwards indicate that it wasn't Hariri's decision, it was a Saudi decision, and it definitely wasn't only a Lebanese issue, it was a regional issue. It was Saudi's reaction to Iran's operation in the region, it was a Saudi escalation in rhetoric about all of Iran's operations in the region, mainly in Yemen, but also everywhere else. So Hariri's resignation came in this context. So it's definitely not a Lebanese issue. Nothing really has changed in the past year. Hariri has been a prime minister for a year, and until 2 weeks before his resignation, someone asked him if he was going to resign because there were rumors, and he said definitely not. So nothing happened afterwards except his visit with his meeting with Ali Akbar Vilayati in Beirut 1 day before his resignation, after which he traveled to Riyadh and submitted his resignation. So this is definitely tells a lot about how it happened and who actually pushed for it. So whether he's held hostage or not, I don't think he's held hostage in the sense that he's at the Ritz-Carlton with the other people who were detained.
Well, forgive me, but they have at least reportedly seized his assets, and there's also a great deal of fear, isn't there, because of his father having been assassinated? And I know he holds a Saudi dual citizenship, but probably in fear of his life and his family's lives, isn't he?
Well, he said that there was assassination attempts on his life, but nothing was confirmed. The Lebanese security forces not confirmed this. They said something about Western intelligence telling them, but we don't know. And to be honest, I'm not sure why would anyone want to assassinate him. Like, if people who assassinate others in Lebanon, like the March 14 figures who were assassinated since 2005, were very harsh in their rhetoric against Iran. Hariri provided a perfect cover for Hezbollah in Lebanon. They had a Sunni cover. They had a government cover for everything they wanted to do in Lebanon and from Lebanon to Syria. They needed Hariri. They wanted Hariri at this point, and everything was working well for him. Why would they want to assassinate him? Who else would want to assassinate him anyway? So I'm not sure about this. I think it's more about a part of the Saudi rhetoric against Iran. It's part of the coming escalation, the Saudi escalation against Iran.
But is Hariri also claiming that he is free? He said he's going to return home in a couple of days. And
he will return probably. He will return. He's not like a hostage in the sense that he cannot come back to Lebanon. He will probably return. Everything says that he will return, but he will come with a Saudi message to President Michelin.
And he'll come as a resigned prime minister, and that can open up a whole new political vacuum for Hezbollah, even though, as you said, Hezbollah had good use for him in terms of maintaining their power.
Yeah, this is why Hezbollah wants him. Like, they refused his resignation, because this is something huge. He's coming back to resign in person. Constitutionally, he needs to resign in his own country and submit his resignation personally in face-to-face to the president. And this is why I think he's coming back to do that. But he's going to try to negotiate with the president, and this is what the Saudis want. And if you guarantee that this happens, and basically it's really about Yemen. I really think it's about Yemen. The interview he gave to Future News 2 days ago, he mentioned Yemen a lot, and he mentioned Hezbollah's involvement in Yemen a lot, and this is a priority for the Saudis. So his message is going to be about Hezbollah's involvement in Yemen. It's not going to work, because the Hezbollah's involvement in Yemen is not going to be compromised for Hariri's return. Hariri's cover for Hezbollah in Lebanon is not as important as Yemen for Iran. So I think what's going to happen is that he's going to come back, try to negotiate this with the president, who is going to be very, very pressured to compromise, and it's going to fail, and he will submit his resignation in person. I think this is how it's going to happen. The next day is the problem. Well, it's not about Hariri anymore. It's really about what's going to happen afterwards. Because Hariri, whether he came back or went back to Riyadh, he is going to resign, because nothing's going to change. And this next day is the issue. How is the Saudis going to react? I think they've mentioned several times, they hinted at economic pressures, and this is going to be probably an economic war on Lebanon, something like a Qatari-style war, and blockade, economic pressures, sanctions, etc.
Which is what's going on right now with Yemen. I mean, the blockade. Hani Gadar, again,
exactly,
with us from Washington, is a Friedman Visiting Fellow of the Washington Institute and focuses on Shiite politics in the Levant. Aaron David Miller is also with us from Washington. I want to go to you on the Yemen blockade, if I may, Aaron, because we've got about 900,000 people reportedly suffering as a result, and suffering of cholera, and millions starving. It's getting worse and worse as the blockade continues, possibly described as the biggest humanitarian crisis of our time. And the Saudis, loath to say it, but are working hand in hand with our own government, with the Trump administration, are they not?
I think that's right. First, let me say, Michael, it's a pleasure to be here with you and with Hanin and Janine, who I haven't seen in a while. You know, I think this is part of a broader piece, Michael, including Yemen, a profoundly new Saudi risk readiness, both at home and abroad, which triggering a series of regional developments, which reflect, in my judgment, an imprudent and at times reckless Saudi policy with no end game in sight. I think the Trump administration, and this was not, well, let's be clear, the policy of enabling Saudi Arabia in Yemen is not just a function of the Trump administration. It began initially as a so-called payoff by the Obama administration in an effort to co-opt and buy off the Saudis, who were very upset, as were the Israelis, over the signing of the Joint Comprehensive Agreement, the Iran nuclear deal. But the Trump
Mayor, this is a different administration, but it's also a different administration in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they've, under their new leadership, essentially gone through a purge of all their rivals. They arrested 11 princes and business people and so forth. It's a whole new game, isn't it?
That's my point. And I think that risk readiness, which we longed for many years, State Department. Why can't Saudi Arabia take more responsibility for its own neighborhood? Why can't the Saudis stand up instead of always living in the shadow of consensus? Well, guess what? Don't pray for anything you really don't want. Because right now you have a Saudi Arabia, and it's been proven true in terms of look at Saudi foreign policy, a protracted war in Yemen since 2015, which has, and the Houthis and their Iranian supporters are clearly to blame for this as well. Yemen already a failing state, perfect storm of Saudi missile and airstrikes refueled and enabled by the United States has led to tremendous civilian losses, famine, hunger, and the cholera outbreak. And what do the Saudis, 2 years in, have to show for it? All they've done, essentially, is to embolden the Houthis, provide additional opportunities for an opportunistic Iran to exploit the situation, and provide greater running room for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. All of these things, without any trace of having a political strategy that would somehow ease Yemen's profound dysfunction. And not just Yemen, Michael. Qatar was the next example of Mohammed bin Salman's MBS's judgment. Because 4 months in, you have an economic and political embargo and boycott that is not working. It has simply enabled and deepened Qatari ties to Iran, and the Qataris are prepared to resist. Now we have Lebanon, where the Saudis presumably, in an effort to get the Iranians, Hezbollah and the Houthis, to back off missile launches, which are a serious problem for the Saudis. 34 reported ballistic missile launches, probably double that number in reality. One intercepted last week by a Patriot missile, which costs every time the Patriots intercept $2 to $3 million, while it only costs the Houthis $1 million to launch one of these missiles, has created serious angst for the Saudis. So,
and how much do the Saudis connect the dots here to Iran? I mean, obviously in a very significant way, dramatic way, in total way, don't they?
Yes, the Saudis are absolutely persuaded, and you know, the Iranian role is unclear. I think they clearly are providing technical support. How many Iranian advisors there are in Yemen is unclear, but I doubt if the Houthis on their own could have improvised and changed the configuration of some of these Scud variant missiles to almost hit King Khalid International Airport. That's 700 kilometers from the Saudi-Yemeni border. And if MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, is interested in attracting foreign investment, the last thing he wants is a security environment in which one of the major airports in the kingdom is threatened by Houthi missiles. So the Saudis have a legitimate problem there. It's just that they have no real strategy, it seems to me, to cope with it. And yes, the Trump administration, I think the president in particular, is fallen under the spell of King Salman, but particularly under MBS, as has his son-in-law, Mr. Kushner.
Well, in fact, Mr. Kushner, let me go to Janine Zakaria, who's here with us in studio, who is a former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post, was right there before all this began. I mean, all this recent volatility, Janine. I mean, the timing there?
Yeah, I mean, it does raise a lot of questions about what exactly Jared Kushner is doing in these secret meetings in Saudi Arabia. There is wide speculation that there is an effort here to go back to an old formula that I know Aaron's familiar with, where, you know, let's get the Saudis and the Israelis cooperating together, maybe try and sign off on what the Saudis are trying to do domestically. The Saudi peace plan that famously the king handed to Tom, took out of his drawer and handed to Tom Friedman back in 2002, I think. But so it's not an incredibly new idea. But try and say, I think if there's a quid pro quo here, and we don't know for sure, okay, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, you want to do this purge domestically, you want to seize the assets of these people, you want us to help you refuel in Yemen, all this and all that, but we need you on the peace process. So in that line, it wasn't only Prime Minister Hariri who was summoned to Riyadh. President Abbas, also Palestinian President Abbas, was summoned, also told to make sure that the other Palestinian factions are distancing themselves from Iran. So there's a lot going on there. But I think it would be useful to know from a policy perspective just exactly what happened in the conversations that Jared Kushner had in Riyadh before the purge began.
What do you think, Janine, are the dangers here? I mean, it's become so much more volatile. It's always volatile, but been exacerbated in recent weeks of a proxy war becoming a real all-out war in the region. I mean, you know, we can only speculate, perhaps, but things seem to be heating up to an unnatural extent. And the reality is that maybe the Saudis and Iran would like to go to war with one another, and perhaps there's a possibility of Israel going to war with Hezbollah, too. I mean, this is all in the works as possibilities, and despite what's going on in Syria.
Right. So I think it's important to bring up Syria as well. I think what's happening here on a couple of levels. First of all, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, he's trying to consolidate his power as this very young son, 32. So he's dealing with domestic issues of unemployment. And you think of this as an opulent country, but he's actually trying to like fill the coffers there. So he's basically confiscating the money from all these people to give him enough money to run the country. At the same time, he's looking at the region. And who are the big players in the region, Michael? You've got Iran, Turkey, and Israel. And the Saudis want to be the big player there. They see what's happening in Syria, for example, where President Assad is consolidating his wins. This is a huge setback for the Saudis, who backed Sunni rebels against him. They see what's going on in Lebanon, where Hezbollah is more powerful. And so they are looking for a way to, and they feel very much at risk and very insecure as a result of the Iran nuclear deal, which Aaron referenced. So I don't expect there to be a full-on war between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Saudis are not good at prosecuting a war, as we can see from the way this is going in Yemen. I mean, I think a third of all their strikes have hit civilian targets, even with American targeting information. So, but yes, I am concerned about the prospect of Israel being dragged into another war with Hezbollah, and it would be far more dangerous than the 2006 conflict.
And what do you think about the resolution that went through the House of Representatives last night? That's pretty significant, isn't it?
Well, I think it's interesting that Ro Khanna, our own South Bay congressman, actually got this on the floor. It's been long overdue, 2.5 years of the U.S. Playing a significant role in this cataclysmic Saudi war against the Yemeni civilian population there. So I think while it's non-binding, I think it could raise the profile of this issue here and maybe put some pressure on the Trump administration to rethink, although I have no expectation that President Trump will say anything critical of this MBS, Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
And Aaron David Miller, the Trump administration has sent presumably a team, that's at least according to Peter Baker in the New York Times, over to Israel to make a deal, to broker a deal with the Palestinians. And the status of that from your perspective, or the possibility of that, there doesn't seem to be much new here. But at the same time, they're suggesting that they have plans that can move forward.
I mean, I think sometime, perhaps by year's end, I doubt it, though by early next, I think the administration is on the hook to lay out something. What it will be is unclear. I can't imagine in many respects a least propitious time to try to broker an agreement on the core issues between two leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, who neither have the will or the ability to make the kinds of choices and decisions on issues like Jerusalem border security, refugees, end of claims and conflict. But I think that the president is committed to his, quote, ultimate deal. So I do believe that by early next year, you'll see some sort of initiative which probably will have three components. One, a general set of principles which purport to address these core issues in the negotiation, how detailed, unclear. Second, a set of political and economic confidence builders designed to promote a greater degree of cooperation between Israelis and Palestinians. And Mr. Greenblatt has been working on those.
This is Jason Greenblatt.
Right. And finally, I think The one factor that is new, and Jeanine referred to it, how much it will actually translate into peace process currency is unclear, and that is the increasing alignment for a variety of non-peace process reasons between the Israelis and the Saudis. I don't think the Saudis are prepared to go as far as the Israelis may want with respect to normalization unless the Israelis are prepared to make fundamental alterations in their approach toward the Palestinians. But I do believe, since that spell has been cast on Mr. Trump and Mr. Kushner, that there will be a piece of this initiative that will look like coordinated, sequenced, and reciprocal steps that Saudis and the other Gulf states, particularly the Emiratis, are willing to take with respect to some degree of contact with the Israelis, some degree of normalization, as part of an effort to facilitate, to supplement this Israeli-Palestinian track. But Michael, let's be very clear. The Arabs cannot and will not rise up to replace Palestinians as a negotiator. They can nudge the process along, but the core decisions that remain to be tackled are ones that the Israelis and Palestinians have proven uniquely ill-equipped to tackle over the last decade and a half.
Is there, in your judgment, more of a movement towards some kind of unity between Hamas and Fatah, despite the fact that, as you say, Mahmoud Abbas appears to be in a pretty weak position overall?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's functional unity. It's unity designed to ease the crisis of political legitimacy that Abbas faces and ease the economic and political mess that Hamas has gotten themselves into through any number of poorly conceived policies with respect to Gaza. But is it real unity? Is it unity of one gun, one authority, one negotiating position that would, in fact, unite the Palestinian national movement, which at the moment looks still looks like Noah's Ark? And there are two of everything, two constitutions, two statelets, two sets of security services, two visions of where Palestine is and what it's supposed to be. No, it's not that kind of unity.
Aaron David Miller, appreciate your being with us. We have to say goodbye to you, regretfully. But
always a pleasure, Michael, and goodbye to Hanin and Jeanine.
Thank you. We will continue with Hanin and Jeanine, and we'll also continue with you, our listeners. In fact, let me take this opportunity to invite you to participate in the program with any questions or comments you might have. We're getting a general picture of what's going on in the Middle East, and it is specifically difficult to laser in because there are so many questions, obviously. But I know you have questions as well, and I want to bring them to the fore as well as comments you might have. You can join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, whether you're listening to us now on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join us, 866-733-6786, for you to join the conversation. You can also let us know what's on your mind or any questions or comments you might have by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website and posting questions or comments there. It's kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways you can join us. We do welcome your questions or your comments. Again, Hanin Gadar with us, Friedman Visiting Fellow with the Washington Institute. She focuses on Shiite politics in the Levant. And here in studio is Jeanine Zakaria, who is visiting lecturer at Stanford and former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. When we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the latest developments in the Middle East, including the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and the resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. With us in studio is Jeanine Zakaria, visiting lecturer at Stanford and the former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for the Washington Post. And with us by phone from Washington is Hanin Gadar, Friedman Visiting Fellow with the Washington Institute. We also spoke with Adam David Miller previously, Vice President for the New Initiatives and Distinguished Fellow with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And we do want to hear from you if you have thoughts about ongoing crisis in the Middle East, crises, I should say, and many questions hovering over diplomacy there and what is actually taking place and what might be taking place or happening. it's a very volatile and mercurial and at the present unstable situation, and one with many questions hovering over it. You may want to add your voice. You can do that by joining us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or emailing us forum@kqed.org or posting questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I wanted to mention that both Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates have all ordered their citizens to leave Lebanon. We began by talking about Lebanon with Hanin Gadar, who focuses on Shiite politics in the Levant. And could, before we go to our calls and our emails, Hanin, could you say something about the cholera disaster, because it's pretty much man-made, unfortunately, sadly, tragically, and it's being spread and to a great extent tied to the politics of the war.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Can you repeat your question?
Yeah, I just wanted you to comment on the cholera epidemic, how tied it is to what's going on in terms of what we're describing as the volatility there and the politics of war and so forth.
Oh, yeah, in Yemen, of course. Yeah, of course, the Yemen situation has escalated drastically also since last week. This all happened like at the same time with the ballistic missile Yemen coming and landing in Riyadh's airport. And then also this pushed the Saudis to more blockade of Yemen, which is leading to a serious humanitarian crisis. And we are at a point where the Saudis are not going to stop before they make sure the Iranians, and mainly, and this ties you back to Lebanon, right? Because this is a humanitarian crisis related to war. The war is related to the Saudi-Iranian conflict, and then gives you back to Lebanon because Saudi Arabia is sending back Harir to Lebanon to talk about Yemen per se. And what his main message is going to be that Hezbollah has to stop interfering in Yemen. Because the ballistic missiles, apparently it had an Iranian stamp on it and a Hezbollah hand in it. So this is not a Houthi thing. This is an Iranian Hezbollah thing. So Harir is going to come back and discuss Yemen with Aoun and mainly Hezbollah. So this is where we are now. We're at a crossroads with either the Saudis going to get something from it or anything, actually, you know, like whatever Hezbollah can give them so they can actually back off this severe blockade on Yemen, and maybe at one point this humanitarian crisis will get a little bit better. But I read out that, and unfortunately, I don't see like any end to this crisis unless it becomes really like an international concern, because I don't see that Hezbollah really like giving the Saudis anything in Yemen. It's an Iranian decision. It's again like it's a Saudi decision that Hariri resigned. It's an Iranian decision what Hezbollah does in the region. It's not a Hezbollah decision. Hezbollah doesn't decide anything.
Yeah, but you say so the crisis will not be resolved unless it moves into an international realm, but we saw how effective international realm crisis was in adjudicating or coming to some resolution in Syria. I'm sorry to cast that kind of rather shadowy notion here, but let me go back, if I may, to Janine Zakaria, because the key question here, and it's often asked by our listeners, and let me get your response, Janine. This is a listener who simply writes, between supporting terrorism, accelerating failed states, strengthening our enemies, and human rights abuses, Saudi Arabia should be our arch enemy, yet we continue to regard them as an ally. I understand the business interest, but why are they still an ally?
Well, when you look back at the 2011 Arab revolutions, when I was there for the Washington Post and we were watching Hosni Mubarak fall and lots of other governments throughout the region, it was sort of the Saudis were, the United States just held on to them as the rock of reliance in the region. I mean, obviously there's the oil element as the number one oil producer, but also as a regional stabilizer when it comes to the Middle East. But I agree with the caller that we need to have a more sober and honest assessment of the Saudis, because especially for when it comes to human rights, but also when they interfere with our interests. But just for a couple of examples, I mean, this is, I mean, not a natural ally for us. You've got a Saudi blogger, Raif Badawi, who's been sentenced to 5 years in prison and 1,000 lashes in public for what they said was insulting Islam online. Another guy who I interviewed when I was there, Mohammed Fahad Al-Qahtani, 10 years for tarnishing the reputation of the state. This is a guy who went to Indiana University and a human rights activist. These issues never come up, especially I do not expect them to come under President Trump. And I think also,
how many of those, by the way, who hijacked airlines and 9/11 were of Saudi descent? The great majority of them. And how much is Saudi Arabia spreading essentially jihadist philosophies throughout the world? I mean, these are really major kind of things that the caller is raising.
Exactly. And they continue to export Wahhabi Islam, the more hardline version of Islam, although they have, you know, their support for terrorist groups like ISIS has they've moved to a more of a combating them role because they have ISIS has struck inside Saudi Arabia. But so we still rely on them as sort of the rock in the region. But it would be nice to have a little bit more of, like I said, a more honest appraisal of where we disagree with them.
Well, their new leader, Mohammed bin Salman, is presenting himself as essentially somewhat progressive. Women are driving suddenly. He's saying, I'm rooting out corruption instead of purging people. I mean, you know, it's a lot of this is messaging.
Yes.
I want to hear from our listeners, though. And let me begin. Our caller, Suleiman, is our first caller. Good morning, Suleiman.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So my first question is, given the tremendous civilian casualties that are taking place in Yemen and all the human rights abuses that Saudi Arabia has been conducting over the past few years, why has there not been greater international pressure? I don't expect much from the Trump administration right now, but in terms of international pressure from the EU or other countries, in terms of trying to speak out in terms of these violations that are taking place?
Yeah, it's an important question. And Hanin Gadar, you mentioned the need for more international attention. Why is there, at this point, less or not enough international attention, do you think?
I think there it's getting more attention at this point, but it's still not enough. Because probably one, that Yemen is considered to be an Iranian-Saudi conflict. It's not an international conflict. And there are so many conflicts in the Middle East, it's hard to focus on one. And so far, strategically speaking, and in terms of priorities, for Saudi Arabia, Yemen is a priority, but not for the rest of the world, because its proximity to other countries, it's really a Gulf matter. They consider it a Gulf matter.
It's a poor country. And there's not a lot of oil there, too, right?
Exactly. Yeah, this too. So Iraq is more important, definitely for the U.S. Iraq is number one priority when it comes to the region per se, and you can see that like a lot of focus has been on like Abadi, kind of soft diplomacy. Syria is definitely also not on the issue. Like if you talk about Yemen, the crisis in Yemen, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, we also have a huge humanitarian crisis in Syria that's been going on for years, and again, no one did anything. This administration is not doing anything, and the past administration didn't do anything to stop it. It's not a priority for anyone at this point. More people have died in Syria in the past few years than anywhere else. Like the war is not going to stop anytime soon also, and again, the humanitarian crisis in both countries is not getting the attention of the international community because the priorities are somewhere else. Again, so this is one of the reasons. It's really politics. I don't see, since Syria really began, I don't think the humanitarian issue is really what moves the international community anymore. It's really politics and businesses. It's the humanitarian issues are not going. It will move the public opinion maybe at one point, which will push the international community, but it's not going to be a priority.
So sad reckoning, and let me thank Suleiman for his call and go right to another caller, and that's you, Donna. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I want to ask about Gaza. With regard to the unity government, there's some hope that opens the borders and it could lift the blockade. My organization, Rebuilding Alliance, is getting solar lights through, and we've sent 27,000 to non-governmental organizations. We can see the importance of, you know, if people had a job, they could pay their own electric bills. There's a simple solution to so much of that crisis. What do you see for hope for opening the blockade to Gaza?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Donna, we'll go to Janine Zakaria.
So, I mean, one of the, talking about forgotten areas in the Middle East that need assistance, Gaza is certainly among them, and the 2014 war between Israel and Hamas, you know, devastated Gaza. They're still dealing with routine hardship, electricity shortages, things that are problems that could be solved if that blockade was eased. And so you do have this the movement toward reconciliation between Fatah, President Abbas, and the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip. And they're going to have another meeting on November 21st, I think. But I don't see that directly linking to the Israelis fully lifting the blockade. That would require a more fundamental shift in Hamas's position vis-a-vis Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in general. So while it's good that maybe, as the caller's suggesting, that more things are getting in, I don't see that as imminent.
Here's a question, rather provocative question, Janine. I don't know if you can necessarily give us some illumination on this, but Kai writes, how likely is it that the Trump administration's stance regarding Saudi Arabia's a quid pro quo for an investment in Kushner's 666 Fifth Avenue project?
Look, there has been some speculation that there could be some business outcome at the end of this, but the lack of transparency regarding the visits, and, you know, I've covered a lot of diplomacy over the past 20 years. This is very shadowy. It's not that we haven't had secret missions, but given what we know about the way the Trump administration and the financial hardships of the Kushner family, I guess it's a possibility, but I really don't want to speak to it because we just don't know. We haven't seen the reporting on it.
Let me bring more of our callers aboard here, and let me go next to Damien. You're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning. My first sort of comment here is to Janine Zakaria with regard to Israel. I don't think Israel needs to be pulled in and dragged into a war. They're already having a little low-level kind of military activity in Syria already. But my two questions are with regard to, one, do they think that there might be a possibility of a blowback in Saudi Arabia due to the aggressiveness of the purge by Mohammed Salman? And the other one is Jerusalem, right? Friedman, the ambassador to Israel, was at the American Zionist Organization last night and basically guaranteed to the audience that the capital, the United States, would recognize Jerusalem as the capital. And if that happened, I don't see any possibility of a peace agreement.
Thank you. I had two good questions. Let me go, Janine, to you first of all on Jerusalem as a capital. I mean, it's been something that the Trump administration initially was promising. Now they're backing away. Samuel Friedman, the ambassador, clearly is all in favor of that. In fact, you know, he's in favor of ongoing settlements, but we won't get into that. But what are your thoughts just generally about what the caller is raising here?
Let me just say that I agree with the caller that there's a lot of tension along the Israel-Lebanon-Syria border area there. But as far, you know, at the moment, Israel is playing a defensive game whenever there's, strike aircraft or whatever in the area that are threatening, then they are getting involved. That's true. But we ain't seen nothing yet. Let's put it that way. What could happen? Hezbollah has stocked more than 10,000 long-range missiles. I mean, Israel had to evacuate a third of the north of the country the last time they had a war in 2006. Now, when it comes to Jerusalem, yes, the President Trump, as president-elect and as a candidate, promised to relocate the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's backed down from that, just as previous presidents have, and I don't see that as imminent, despite Ambassador Friedman's hardline pro-Likud, even further right than the Likud position on this. And frankly, I don't think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is even pushing for it because he knows that could be inflammatory, even if it would be popular with his very right-wing pro-settlement coalition that you alluded to, Michael. I just don't see that as being pushed. He could say what he wants at the ZOA dinner, but that's not something that I think is imminent.
And Hanin Gadar, the caller also raised a question about blowback from Saudi aggression from the new administration or the new regime there. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Sure. This is, if you want to put it in the regional context, like the Saudis, I think like the whole escalation, they were hoping for two things. One, internally to consolidate power and make sure that the vision of MBS is going further without any hurdles. And this is something that, like internally, there was a message to Saudis themselves that this is what I want, this is how I'm going to do it, and no one's going to stop me. And the Saudis are not used to this kind of methods. It hasn't happened. Like, this is unprecedented. So, yeah, maybe. We don't know. But also, we have to think about the context of this. While this is happening, there was also regional escalation. And I think at one point, they were hoping for two things. One, the war against ISIS in the region is almost over. At least let's say that the caliphate is over. Maybe the war against ISIS itself is not over, but the first phase of it is. The caliphate is no more. So they were hoping that the anti-ISIS coalition might actually alter its composition or its mission and to become an anti-Iran coalition. They were hoping that the rhetoric, the anti-Iran rhetoric by the U.S. administration would turn into action by transforming this coalition to start fighting Iran proxies in the region, especially the Iran Shia militias in Syria, starting with Hezbollah, and then you have all the Afghanis, Pakistanis, Fatimiyun, Zainabiyun, Iraqi, Hashd al-Shaabi, etc. This is what they want. So far, and of course, they would want like another war with between Israel and Hezbollah. Also, you need the U.S. to be on board with that. But there's something that is why this is not working. It's mainly because the next war with Hezbollah and the next war is really not going to be a Lebanese war. It's going to be a war against Iran because Hezbollah is now part of the Quds force. It's not just a Lebanese militia. It's fighting everywhere, including Yemen. And this is what's really dangerous about the next war. It's a regional war. It's a war against Iran. And even if everybody really wants this war, the anti-Iran people want this war, but no one is ready to fight it. And this is what they didn't understand. So it will, at one point, they will realize that the war is not happening. So the regional context will influence the internal context. How this is going to develop? Maybe they're going to go single-handedly on economic war on Lebanon or some creating some kind of proxies here and there. So this is going to lead to more chaos and more conflicts. I can't really tell how this is going to backfire or if it's going to backfire, but yeah, this is something, a reaction that without a strategy. So usually an action like this without having a strategy or a plan, hoping that others will come on board, doesn't really end well. So this is something that we need to think about.
And again, Hanin Gadar is with us from the nation's capital. She's Friedman Visiting Fellow for the Washington Institute. I want to bring, we've been talking about humanitarian crises, and as many of you know, there was one of the deadliest earthquakes, well, the deadliest earthquake of so far this year in Iran. Recent death toll, about over 400 dead and thousands injured, many more who have lost everything. And the trade embargo goes on with Iran, and a number of people are concerned about how they can get help through or how they can aid those who are suffering as a result of this earthquake. So I want to bring on Donna Favard, who is National Field Manager for the National Iranian American Council. And Donna Favard, good to have you with us on Forum. Welcome to the program. Donna Favard, do we have you on?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, for a moment I couldn't, but now I can. Thank you for joining us. There are a number of people probably wondering how they can help in recovery efforts, and I know the Treasury Department has licensed citizens here in the United States to actually engage in certain activities to assist relief efforts following any natural disasters, but specifically this one in Iran with the earthquake, though the embargo continues. Can you give us some advice to those who really actually wanted help and are willing to help?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are three things that people can do if they do want to help. One is that they can donate food or clothing or medicine to Iran, provided that the donations are meant to relieve human suffering and are not directed to the government in Iran, an Iranian bank, or any other restricted parties. This is a little bit unclear, so we suggest that folks will donate to an organization that is on the ground. So in that case, for anyone who is a U.S. citizen, they have to donate to an organization that is a U.S. U.S. NGO engaged in the humanitarian services. So folks cannot donate to any groups that are Iran-based that may be doing humanitarian work on the ground.
So that's the basic distinction. I mean, you want to find a non-governmental organization, an NGO to donate to, as opposed to an Iranian-based organization.
Exactly.
Yeah. And can't you also seek license from the department, the Treasury Department, I think Office of Foreign Assets Control, to engage in humanitarian activities?
Yes. Yes, and that's the third thing that folks can do if they're interested in aiding in the humanitarian relief.
So charitable organizations, I'm looking at some that are listed here, Moms Against Poverty, Child Foundation, Children of Persia, Relief International. These are all bona fide and okay to donate to.
Yes, exactly. And these are groups that we've worked with in the past during the earthquake in 2012 as well.
But you can donate food or clothing or medicine directly to Iran, provided the donations are meant to relieve human suffering, not directed to the government of Iran.
Exactly. It is a little bit funky. So the best way to give those donations is to just travel to Iran with the supplies yourself. Obviously, there are concerns with doing that. There are a lot of folks who are visa holders in the United States who are now grappling between whether or not they're going to go back home and help their families with the relief, or whether they're going to stay here out of fear of losing their visa or not being able to re-enter because of something that might potentially happen around Trump's travel ban.
Well, I wish you good fortune in terms of helping the people who obviously desperately need help over there, and I thank you so much for joining us. Donna Favard, again, is National Field Manager of the National Iranian American Council. And we're going to go back to some of your calls and emails. Again, we're talking about the latest developments in the Middle East, including the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and the resignation of Lebanon's Prime Minister, Saad Hariri. Janine Zakaria is here with us in studio. And Janine, actually a comment from Hamid I'd like to get your response to. Says, why does your guest state that Israel might get dragged into a war, whereas it is Israel that threatens war? That dynamic is always in play. Also, Iran has signaled willingness to accept an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal, making such agreement good to all parties.
I have no belief at all or any sense that Israel would launch an offensive war against Hezbollah right now, simply put.
And with respect to Iran signaling willingness to accept a deal between Israel and Palestine?
Tell them to send me the deal.
Okay. Another question that I want to go. Well, let me go to more callers. But actually, it's a question about famine and war. Let me go to you on this, Hani and Gadar. Mike writes, Yemenis were starving long before the war because of drought-induced famine, which caused them to move to the cities. The famine caused the war as much as the war caused the famine. Finding ways to irrigate their fields would have helped stave off the war. Do you agree with that, Hani?
I wasn't paying attention. So, can you repeat your question?
Yeah, it was just a question about whether irrigation of the fields would have helped stave off the war in terms of what's going on in Yemen with the famine.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, so probably you should ask someone who knows more about these details. But I would say yes, definitely.
Okay, and William, you want to comment on that, Jane?
Well, I just think that the situation in Yemen, as Hanin has pointed out and we've been talking about, is really, yes, the famine has got some domestic issues related to that, but it's really a political situation related back to the civil war that started in Yemen around the time of the Arab revolutions, and the Saudis backing the Sunni leader and the Iranians backing the Shia leader and them taking sides and tearing the country apart. So everything has been exacerbated there in the ability of the international community to help and to stave off the starvation because the Saudis see an Iranian takeover of Yemen happening and they see that as a sort of an existential threat. So until that gets resolved, there's not going to be much improvement, unfortunately, in the humanitarian situation there.
William wants to know, Janine, Iranian troop strength, roughly twice that of Saudi Arabia. How would Saudi Arabia effectively confront Iran, and would they expect the United States or others to join them in a regional war?
Well, this is why I said earlier that I don't expect there to be a full-on military direct confrontation between Saudi and Iran. The Iranian, exactly right. I mean, the Iranian
forces are... It's
all
going to be surrogates.
Yeah, surrogate proxy wars that you've got potentially... Lebanon, you've got the Qatar situation as well. Remember a few weeks ago when Saudi Arabia banded together with the other Sunni strong Arab states and basically tried to isolate Qatar because of its connections with Iran and its support for Iran. You've got the Israel-Hezbollah possibility, proxy war. And so I don't anticipate that they could not prosecute that war, and I do not believe that the U.S. would join in a Saudi war against Iran directly. No way.
Another caller joins us. Raul, you're on.
Hi. Really enjoyed the panel and discussion. Great discussion. I have a question about the different perspectives. We've heard people mentioning Israel. We have heard, I guess, maybe a more political aspect to it. For example, the Trump administration, the former administration that was in power. And just from hearing from some of my friends that are international students, some of them are very much in favor of United States intervention. Some of them are very wary and distrustful. So I noticed that there's so many different perspectives out there, and I'm only seeing one main perspective or one or two perspectives shared when I read stories posted in the Times or the Post. So I wanted to ask, what are reliable sources of information to obtain a wide variety of perspectives so that we know what's actually going on, or that we know this is something that might not have gotten as much coverage, but maybe should be considered? And another thing that I wanted to ask...
Well, let me just go to that because we're pretty short on time, and I think it's an important element that we can perhaps answer. We'll go first to Hanin Gidar, and then we'll go to Janine Zakaria. A good source for balanced and full kind of coverage of the Middle East, Hanin Gidar?
Well, when it comes to me looking for information, the Hariri resignation itself, I don't think anyone knows what's going on. So there is like any one source of news because there's no news. So what you have to do is like read everything. I read Western analysis, Western newspapers, and I also read local. And it's interesting to see the difference between local coverage of the situation and the Western coverage. And you can... It's a combination. It's really a combination of many things. I can't like give you one source saying like this is the most reliable source, because you can be reliable today or in one issue and not on another issue, because it's really about their sources.
All right, let's hear from Janine on this. Janine, is it correct? Sources?
Keep reading your major, credible, fact-based American newspapers that are doing a good job covering this, and then dip in on the web to Haaretz, 972, if you want some of the more progressive online sites, and maybe check out Al Hayat. Everything's in English. You can get translated now.
And read as much as you can, and listen to Forum. Stay informed. Thank you for that question, and thank you, our listeners. Thanks for those of you who called and wrote in this hour, and thanks to Janine Zakaria, to Hanin Gidar, to Aaron David Miller, and to Donna Farvard. I hope some of you will indeed take up her challenge of actually helping out in this wake of this earthquake disaster. We're going to talk about fear in the hour ahead. Sasha Bromsky's written a book about the exaggerations of fear. Join us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.